much as we can. I have a secret ambition to try to finish Perek Beis in tonight's shiur. So if you remember, we started last time verses 14 through 19. And we went all the way through that. And we were talking about the girls as they changed from one harem to another, from Haggai's Shaarim to Sha'ashgaz's Shaarim, and they're called women and maidens, two different harems, and it depended whether or not they had gone through the whole year and met with Ahasuerus or not at that stage. And if they had already met with Ahasuerus, which took them a year to prepare for, then after that they went to Sha'ashgaz's harem. And they were only ever coming back to Ahasuerus if he called for them by name. But once he met Esther, that was it. And he fell in love with her. And there were still maidens who were going through the year-long process to meet with Ahasuerus, who as yet had not met Ahasuerus. And he decided, oh no, what happens if there's a better girl than Esther available for me? So he lined them all up in a pageant and he kind of examined them visually just to look at them and see whether or not he thinks, you know, that he would like her more than Esther. And he said, no, I'm absolutely sure now, without a doubt, that Esther is going to be my queen. And therefore, we're going to end this whole procedure of me meeting all these girls. And I'm just going to pick Esther. I found the one that I want. And I'd like to go through in verse 19. There's a few things in verse 19, in verse 17 as well. Let's just have a quick look at 16, 17, 18 and 19 again. Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his palace. Remember we said to his palace, not to the second harem. Because he was so enamored with her, he moved her into his palace on the 10th month, which is Tavis, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther above all the women. Who are the women? Who are the women? When it says the Nosh, the women, what does that mean? It means the women he had already been with. So comparing her to all the other women he's already met, he loved her more. She was favored and found grace before him. What's the difference between those two? Favored and grace? Got to learn that. What's the difference? If I favor you, isn't that showing you grace? If I show you grace, am I not favoring you? More than did all the other maidens, Basulois. Who's that? That's not the women, that's the maidens. These are the maidens he's not yet met. So how could he have grace over them? He hasn't met them yet. So he placed the royal crown upon her head. Personally, we're going to learn out. He did that. And made her queen in Vashti's stead. Let me ask you something. Do you make someone queen and then place the crown on their head? Or do you place the crown on their head and make them queen? We're going to learn out. You have to be a queen before you get the crown on your head. The crown going on your head does not what make you queen. You're queen anyway. You're queen elect. You can't say the only time you're going to be queen. If a queen never wears a crown, is she not a queen? The king made a great banquet for all his ministers and servants. It was Esther's banquet. Notice it was Esther's banquet, not Queen Esther's banquet. Have we not just been told she's Queen Esther now? And he waived taxes for the provinces and presented gifts worthy of the king. That must have been nice. When the maidens, who are the maidens? The ones who had not yet met with him and they were gathered for a beauty pageant, were gathered a second time in the courtyard where Mordechai was already sitting. What does that mean? He already had a place of prominence, which we need to discuss. Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate. We need to be told that because we need to understand the political structure was that Mordechai didn't get placement because of his relationship to Esther. How do we know that? Because Esther hid her identity. So nobody would say, oh, I'm Mordechai's, you know, first cousin. Oh, we better promote Mordechai. Mordechai was a Choshev HaMensch anyway. And he had his own political clout, irrelevant of his relationship to Esther. That's key, and we need to know that. He was already sitting at the gate at this time in the seventh year of the reign in Tavus. He's already there. We need to know that. That's absolutely key. Can I ask anyone who's joining late to please mute themselves, if that's possible? Okay. Now let's go in to these verses 17 through 19. There's so much to glean, and I want to move at pace because I'd like to get through to the very end of this perek, which is Pasuk Chof Gimel 23, and we're holding by 19, so the end is in sight. But there's a lot to do, a lot to do. So let's try to talk about it. I think that these words are very, very subtle, but they're very, very apt. And the Medrash Rabbah and the Eitz Yosef, which is a commentary on the Medrash Rabbah, and the Al Shech HaKadosh all say things which are most profound in the subtlety of the words. It says regarding the women who the king had already seen, that he loved Esther above all of them. Now, he had been together with each and every one of these women. So the king knew that he loved none of them for sure as much as he loved Esther. Because he knows these women. However, with reference to the maidens whom Ahasuerus gathered before him at the second gathering, it says that the expression is, she was favoured and found grace. Because the king was merely judging them for those qualities when he looked at them. What was he looking for? They were all the most good-looking girls in all of Persia. So they were all beautiful. That's not what he was looking for. Beauty was already organized by the people that got them into the pageant. That was by the people going around the town picking up these girls. What was he looking for? He was looking for chayin. He was looking for a certain chayin, a certain favor, a certain grace that kind of was about this woman that he saw in Esther. With the women that he's already actually been with, he knows he loves Esther more than those. But with the women he's never met before, he's merely looking, is there some kind of extrasensory, what do you call it? A charisma? An aura? Some kind of star quality that you're looking for in a person, in an audition? Is this person got the X factor that you're looking for? And that's what he was looking for with these girls. He was looking, not were they beautiful, they were all beautiful. He was looking, does this woman have that star, like she's like a queen in waiting. There's something about her, the way that she holds herself, the way that she moves, that makes her look like a queen. And he looked them all over and he goes, nah, Esther's got it better than all of them. When I compare her to a woman that I've actually been with, she's better than all the other women that I've been with. And I look at her and go to a woman, as does she have the bearing of the Empress of Persia? None of them have what she has. In fact, the girls already knew it. We said last week that the girls all ingratiated themselves to Esther in the harem because they noticed something was different about her. She seemed royal from the get-go. So people were treating her as if she was already the... Hagar already thought she was the queen. He'd been treating like that for years. Gave her own room, her own goods, gave her gifts beyond all the other. He said, for sure, this one's going to win it. And indeed, that was the case. It made sense. There was something about her. That was a divine gift. It was a divine gift. HaKadosh Baruch Hu bestowed upon her some kind of charisma, some kind of attitude, some kind of bearing that you just looked at her and you would think, queen. There was just... I remember I met a woman who starred in a play where she was playing Queen Victoria in theatre. And she said that when people would meet with her afterwards, they would avert their eyes, they would lower their gaze. And she would have to tell them, I was just pretending. I'm an actress. I wasn't actually Queen Victoria. But she was so convincing that people actually saw her as royal. There's a certain bearing that you have when you're among other people that if you have a royal bearing, people treat you differently. Esther had that. And nobody else had that. And that's what Ahasuerus was looking for. He knew what to look for. He looked them over and said, none of these women are empress material. Even though you're right, he hasn't personally known them. The point is that he doesn't need to. He's got everything he needs with Esther. That's what it means in verse 19, when the maidens were gathered a second time. The girls had been assembled under once already on the charge of Haggai, and then again on this special occasion when Ahasuerus was about to crown Esther as queen, but he didn't want to feel as if he's losing out. Maybe there's someone better. We better just check the competition. That's why the verse refers to those maidens as basulais, literally virgins, because the ones that Ahasuerus gathered the second time were those whose turn to see him had not yet arrived. And therefore, as far as he was concerned, they were maidens. That's why we can see that the very first girl in the group did not have relations with Ahasuerus until after the completion of her 12 months, because that's how long it took for her anointment and her perfuming and oils. So it was from when the king began to appoint officers and gathering all the maidens to Shushan through to the arrival of the first girl's turn after her treatment had been completed and continuing on until Esther's turn came. So a period of time extending from the third year of Ahasuerus' reign until the seventh year. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We're looking at solid 4 years where he was meeting girls that he'd never met until he found 4 years. And taking into account all that had to transpire, remember, they've each got to prepare themselves for a year each. When the turn came for Esther, now, by the way, in that pasuk, look at 15. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Avichal, the uncle of Mordechai, who had taken it in as his daughter to come to the king. Why do we need to bring the genealogy back? Now we need to mention her father and the fact that Mordechai adopted her. Have we not got that earlier? What about the first parak? The recording of Esther's lineage to show that she was the daughter of Avichal, and that Avichal was in turn Mordechai's uncle, making Esther his first cousin, and that Mordechai took it in as his daughter, all seems most verbose. And we know from everything we learned in Rus, there's not an extra vowel that's verbose. Some of the things we learnt about in Rus was from an extra dot or the lack thereof in a vowel. Remember that from a segel to a patach? We learnt out she was talking about a Gilgul. The three dots turned to two dots when she turned around to Boaz and says, if I'm the good dove from Moab, and if Machlon is going to be reincarnated. So she, remember that with the two dots to one dot, even the grammatical change of a vowel, we learnt out a whole drosh, let alone a whole sentence we don't need. Something's afoot. What is it? Why does it say Esther was taken rather than she came to the king in verse 14? And then in verse 17 it says, he placed the royal crown upon her head and made her queen. Shouldn't it have just said simply that Ahasuerus crowned her? What would that mean? If I tell you he crowned her, what would that mean? He crowned her and made her queen. What, aren't those "and made her queen" completely useless? I know what crowning someone means. This is not the usual way to describe coronations, with or without a crown. We don't do that. It should have said... The pasuk should have said, he made her queen and placed the royal crown upon her head. And he did that in reverse. He put a crown upon her head and he made her queen. What's the interim? Between the time he put the crown on her head and made her queen, what was she? Royalty is affirmed first, says scripture, and only then do you wear the crown. Also, the words "in Vashti's stead" are completely superfluous. We know she's gone. Why do we need to bring her up? So our rabbis actually teach us in the Medrash Rabbah 6:11 that the words "and he made her queen in Vashti's stead" to mean that he had a portrait of Vashti in his bedroom. Do you know, there's a thing to keep a picture of your loved one on a night table? Ahasuerus had a picture on his night table of Queen Vashti. saying, I don't know, Shushan, 382 AD, when they were on a holiday together and had a picture taken. You know what I'm saying? He loved Vashti and he had a little picture of her in a bedroom. When he fell in love with Esther, he took that picture away and had a portrait made of Esther and put that in his bedroom. What does it mean, in Vashti's stead? Esther has crowbarred Vashti out of Ahasuerus's heart. And now he's as infatuated with Vashti, sorry, with Esther, as he was with Vashti. Literally, she's in her stead, in his heart, in his love for her. All happened very quickly. Isn't that amazing? See, he took down that picture, says the Medrash. Unbelievable Medrash Rabbah, no? He took down that picture and put up a picture of Esther. That's a Medrash Rabbah that says that. Come on, that's amazing. Now, the Gemara, Sanhedrin, Ayin Dalad Omad Beis, 74b. There's a kasha there saying, how could a good Jewish girl like Esther, a frum girl, submit to living with a Gentile? How's that possible? How's that possible? Now, you might suspect her of guilt. You might think, at the end of the day, the Torah actually does say in Megillah that when she came before the king, she was adorned with an abundance of ornaments, and they, of course, are all designed to beautify her and flatter him. And that implicates her being actively and willingly involved in this sin, rather than making her a very reluctant victim who you have to have compassion for under the circumstances. It's a Gemara that questions this. How guilt-free was Esther in all this? The verse itself comes to testify that Esther ran away from being chosen by the king. It was only because God wanted her to be crowned as the queen that he caused her to find favour in everybody's eyes, including Ahasuerus. She made no effort in this whatsoever. She didn't go to, after Kate Middleton was a commoner, and she dressed in a way and walked in a way which was most unsuitable, and we know that the queen was very upset with her. She went to like a finishing school that taught her how to sit, how to get out of a car, how to walk, the whole thing. There's like a finishing school. Esther made no such airs and graces to try to fit in with royalty. She made it her effort to try not to. God gave her this chayin, which everybody saw, even Haggai saw it, everybody saw right from the get-go, to promote her for Klal Yisrael's requirements and to atone for Sha'ol's sin that we talked about in the last parak. She's the one that's been chosen to do this. God will make it happen. Irrelevant of her notwithstanding. She didn't in any way dainty her footsteps to look like a... She didn't want to be there. God forced it upon her by giving her this X-factor charisma that meant that she couldn't help but be there. Esther had a virtue none of the other women possessed. Do you know what Chazal say in the Gemara? She had one possession which no other Gentile woman truly possesses. An innate sense of sneers. That's the Gemara. What was it that Boaz saw in Ruth more than anything else that says there's something special about her? Tzniyus. Impeccable tzniyus. It is the hallmark of Jewish royalty. You see someone behaving with impeccable tzniyus, it's a divine gift of chayin. It just comes with a bag. If you work on your men and women, by the way, there's as many laws in tzniyus with men as there are with women. Very underrated by men. Yes, it's the main avoider for women, especially in our generation. True. But men have underrated the importance. You know, there's even halachas as to what kind of belt buckle you shall wear for a man. That you shouldn't wear something snazzy that attracts people's eyes. How you walk down a set of stairs. There's lots of sneers, you know. What perfume you should wear. There's laws. When you attract yourself to the concept of sneers, and you work within those halachas, a natural chayin comes over you. She had that chayin. Sneers was her chayin. That's where it says, when each girl's turn arrived at the end of 12 months of treatment to prescribe preparing for women, she would still ask for all sorts of additional adornments, embellishments, to accompany her from the harem to the palace. It says that. So that why should she appear more attractive? That was the whole thing, right? When the term came for Esther, the daughter of Avichal, the uncle of Mordechai, who had taken her in as a daughter, the verse says, black and white, she was Esther herself, a righteous woman, not some made-up, pretentious princess. She was the same from Esther. In addition, she was the daughter of Avichal, who was completely righteous. And to show that Avichal was a tzaddik, The Torah itself associates him with Mordechai. It mentions him in the same breath as Mordechai, who we know was a tzaddik. David HaMelech praised him in Tehillim before Mordechai was born as being a tzaddik for raising an orphan. Remember that? We talked about that. The uncle of Mordechai, as if to say, Avichai resembled Mordechai in his virtues, who had taken her in as a daughter. Mordechai provided for her, not just because she was an orphaned relative, but he felt obligated to, and he adopted her, treating her as if she was actually his daughter. What does that mean? He brought her up with a system of Torah values that he would treat his own daughter with. She was a frum girl, right out of Sem. The Sem of Mordechai HaTzadik. We've got no idea. He was the greatest man in five generations, says the Ben Ish Chai. Three before him, two after. We have no idea. Growing up in his house, you're going to learn a lot of Torah. She requested, says the Pasuk, she requested nothing apart from that which Haggai had suggested. Don't adorn me. I'd rather go in looking very plain. I don't want to win this pageant. Esther demonstrated that she was being beautified by Haggai against her will. That's why the Yalkut Shmoni and the Medrash Agada on Esther, Perek Beis, Tes Vav, says Haggai said to her, why cause your own death by refusing to be adorned for the king? We clearly see she was saying, don't make me up. I'm very happy. I don't want to go in. Bichlal. And if I have to go in, I want to look unpleasing. I hope he doesn't pick me. Every other girl came very happily and willing. Think about it. Think about what this meant for her. She's some girl that's been picked up willingly to go there. What happens if she wins? She becomes the most powerful woman on earth, and her children are guaranteed to become kings and viceroys, no matter what. She now becomes one of the most influential people in history. It's a bit of a promotion from some pretty girl walking down the street in Shushan. It's a big career move. Esther didn't want it. She didn't want to go in. So much Haggai had to say, what are you doing? You crazy? This is your one opportunity. She goes, I don't want to go in. She refused to go in when it was her turn until Haggai and his staff actually forcibly picked her up and threw her into the king's bedchamber. She was literally kicking and screaming. Now, we have to think here how Ahasuerus might have seen this himself as a person. Think about it. All the other girls are coming in so beautifully decorated, so willingly. So willingly. When he sees a girl that's clearly there because she doesn't want to be there, how would he feel about that? That's certainly out of character for all the other girls that have been coming in. Maybe he would have said, listen, if you don't want to be here, no one's forcing you, go. Why did the king desire her so much? Weren't all the others returned to Sha'azgaz to become his concubines, while only Esther remained queen? Now, in answer to this big question, if basically he's not a molester, he wasn't molesting these girls against their will. And if Esther didn't want to be there, if anything, she was very unattractive. Think about it. All these other girls were adorned in every beauty. They had musical instruments. A band was playing. She was in there kicking and screaming, saying, let me out. What would make a man fall in love with that? It clearly wasn't a desirous thing to do. Says verse 15, Esther was favored in the eyes of all who beheld her. That expression, notice, is naisais chayn. What does that mean? It means carrying favor. To carry something, as a masui, as a load, to carry a chayn. That's not motza chayn. She found grace in the eyes of all. She was carrying, very unusual loshen. She was carrying some kind of grace. She carried upon herself the favor which God had bestowed upon her, which took the form of a chut shel chesed, a cord of kindness upon her face. As the Gemara Megillah says in Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, there was some, you know when you walk into a room and see a baby, a brand new baby. What is it? There was a comedian that once said, a brand new baby looks like a prune. They are an unlovely object. Yet everyone coos and adores them, says the Medrash Rabbah, that Hashem's Shekhinah rests on a new baby for the first period of time to make sure that everyone loves the baby to take care of it. And people do. People do. There's something about a newborn. It's just this, you've got to look at it. So too, that same favor emanated from Esther. Doesn't matter what she was doing, she had this special divine gift of chayin. Everyone liked her. Even if they were kicking and screaming and crying, going, oh, look what a lovely baby, and there's the baby's crying. Why do people like such a loud, unpleasant thing? Answer is the Shekhinah rests with it. Now, there's another proof. This is clearly a divine proof that Esther was chosen for this. She was clearly made herself not as lovely as the other girls, and yet he fell enraptured. He was infatuated with her, took the picture of Vashti out of his bedroom and had a picture of her put in. Normally, it's far more difficult to find favour in a king's eyes than to find favour in the eyes of anyone else. But Esther was favoured by the king, says the Medrash Rabbah, twice as much as she was favoured by everyone else. God knew exactly how to press Ahasuerus's buttons, and everything about Esther, Poshut made him fall in love with her head over heels. It's completely beyond reason. He made that happen. He made that happen. Everyone saw Esther as something unbelievable. He saw Esther as like almost like semi-divine. It was like unbelievable. Scripture even says Esther was favored in the eyes of all that beheld her. But regarding King Ahasuerus, Esther was not just favored. She also found grace in his eyes. That's what I said to you at the beginning. What's the difference between favor and grace? It's a double whammy. In the king's eyes, she found favor and grace. And she was favored and found grace before him in verse 17, more than did all the other maidens. There was something about her which was just magical for Ahasuerus. Got her into position. Why? Because God wanted her in that political place to save Jewry and to atone for King Shaul. It was divine. It didn't make any sense. She was doing everything to undo it. He certainly didn't molest any of those girls. He certainly didn't. But with her, he was absolute. She could have done anything. She literally could have, I don't know, sneezed in his face and, I don't know, rub herself in lard and make it as unpleasant as possible. He was head over heels. There's nothing she could have done to make him not like her. Why? Done by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Notice it says he placed the royal crown upon her head. He didn't even get a chamberlain or a minister to do it, as would be the norm. Why? He didn't assign the task to a chamberlain because his love, says the Al Sheikh HaKadosh, love distorted his mind. That's the Al Sheikh HaKadosh. He was balmy. He just was, he went nuts. He was nuts about her. I don't know how to explain. He didn't think so. A king doesn't actually pick up a crown, walk over to him and put the crown on her head. There's a whole coronation and a proper event with an invitation and, a town crier. And there's a whole pomp and ceremony. He literally got a crown and put it on her head. He went bonkers. He went a bit mad. He made her queen in Vashti's stead personally. He considered Esther a worthy replacement for Vashti, who was a distinguished daughter of great kings in her own right. Interesting, huh? Also, Esther took over Vashti's royal title, and Vashti herself simply became Vashti. Do you notice that in the Pasuk? And he replaced Vashti with Queen. Vashti's now just stunned Vashti. She's not a queen, she's gone. It's just like she's nothing. That's why the verse doesn't say in Queen Vashti's stead. It says in Vashti's stead. Now, the Gemara Megillah on Yud Gimel Amud Aleph 13a says that Esther was favored in the eyes of all who beheld her. Rav Elazar explains that verse teaches us that every single nation out of the 127 provinces claimed Esther as their own. It's amazing, isn't it? I've noticed this. When people see something that's really great, they are, it must be she's one of us. She must be Macedonian. Macedonian are the best. The best women are Macedonian. The best cheese, the best wine. It must be. Oh, it's French. Ah, the best cheese, the best wine, it's French. Everyone thinks the best of everything is their own. So when they saw Esther, they thought as if she must be one of our she's one of us. Of course he loves her. Of course he's going to love us because we're the best. Now those words are not so, that idea is not so readily understood from the verse. So what's Rav Elazar, how does he understand that from this verse? He says that there's a problem, a difficulty which we raised earlier. The verse should have said, Esther moitzos chayim. She should have found grace, not carried grace. That's a linguistic problem. It must mean that much favour shone from her face that when a member of one of the other nations beheld her radiating such favour, he must have concluded, this woman must have issued from my nation, because I would never feel so well disposed to someone unless I feel as if they're like me. Do you hear that? People love themselves the most. You're most well disposed to yourself. So if you feel that well disposed to someone else, it must be they're like you. Otherwise you wouldn't like them that much. Isn't that amazing? By virtue of a kinship, I must feel that I like you that much. It must be because I like you that much that you're from, probably from my hometown, probably from down my street. You're one of us. I remember I needed a couch being fixed. And I actually looked up in the yellow, I know I had a yellow pages that was posted to my door. I don't use it, but I looked it up and there's a couch repair guy in it. So I phoned him up and I said, listen, you know, I've got a couch repair. So he said, yeah, it's going to be this much and this much. He said, where are you based? So I said, Salford. And he said, we're in Salford as well. You know what? I'll give you a discount. Now, why did he say that to me? He said, you're a Salforder. I'm a Salforder. You're a Salforder. You know what? I'm going to do you a favour. That chain was a chain from the fact that he said, you're one of mine. You probably support Salford FC and Salford Rugby Club. You're a Salforder. So you know what? We've got to stick together. That kind of chain emerges because if I like you, it must be that I like you because you like me. That's what it means she carried in. That's why Rav Elazar understood every nation claimed her as herself, because it wasn't normal for people to like someone that much. It must be she's one of us. Verse 20. Ain Esther Megedes, she did not relate over, she did not tell about her origin or her people, just as Mordechai had commanded her. And Esther continued to obey Mordechai's directive, just as she had done when she was being raised by him. Now in verse 19, just before this one, it said when the maidens were gathered in, what's the connection of the maidens being gathered in and Mordechai sitting at the gate? Now you might say on verse 20 as follows. It's very unlikely that Esther did not tell of her people or her origin because Mordechai was sitting at the gate. And from there, he directed her to keep silent. He went, shh, shh, because she saw him there, shh, and he said, shush, no. Even without Mordechai's presence at the gate, Esther would still have known to have kept her origin a secret, as we said in verse 19 and earlier, because she did it out of emunas chachomim. She did it out of the idea that she wanted to obey the Rav. The Rav told her, don't tell anyone about the fact that you're Jewish, and especially that you're related to me, and that you're a Benjaminite. Don't tell anyone about. So she kept shtum, not because Mordechai was there egging her on, saying whatever you do. She knew to get, whether he was there or not, it was irrelevant. She would keep the mitzvah as it would. She held it like a mitzvah, like a mitzvah d'rabbanon, not to, because a Rav told her not to do it. Esther still didn't tell. That's why it says, Ain Esther Menege, she still didn't tell. What does still mean? That implies she was following Mordechai's original instruction much earlier on that we learnt last time. Notice in verse 19 it says, Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate. What does that mean? It means he had a position of power and authority. Where do we learn that from in the Torah? Where do we learn that sitting at the gate means that we've got a position of power and authority? Where in the Torah do we see that? Answer? Light. Light was sitting at the gate when the angels came in. And remember that when he wouldn't open the door to the angels, they said, look at this man. He comes here and he acts as a judge above us. They had appointed him as a judge, so he had to sit at the gate. Just like we learned from Boaz, who went to the gate in order to find the judges. So Lot was ascended as a judge in Sodom. So too, Mordechai had a very high power. He was sitting at the gate. And we learn that out in Bereshis, Yud Tes Aleph, Genesis 19:1, and see the Medrash Bereshis Rabbah, 50, section 3 on that, which talks about what I'm just telling you about. So the fact that Mordechai's at the gate, we already know from Lot, that's a position of power. We already know from Boaz, that's a position of power. Mordechai sitting there means he had a position of authority anyway. Why did he have that? God appointed Mordechai to a high position in order to extract revenge against Haman. Because as we know and we learnt out from the past 2-3 sessions, two redeemers were going to be necessary to accomplish this task. Mordechai and Esther individually had to attain their positions of status in a way that defied natural means, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to make sure that anyone that was looking at the Megillah knew it was from him and not some kind of regular development. Doesn't make sense. Mordechai, a Jew who was so reviled that if a Jew touched a pot, everything was treif, but if a worm went in it, it was fine. How did he get to such high status so quickly as a Jew? And two is, how did Esther get to where she got so quickly? Clearly, this was miraculous. There's no other way to explain this apart from divine providence. It doesn't make sense otherwise. God is doing this on purpose to make sure when you look into the Megillah, his name's everywhere without being written once. Now, the Megillah has already said how Esther rose to greatness in a supernatural way. But that Mordechai held such a high position doesn't make sense. Isn't it true that he attained power only after Esther was crowned? Wasn't it only then that she recommended Mordechai to this? This is a very important point. It's a worth coming moment. Put your ears together for this. This is important. The verse is written very carefully by Chazal. Mordechai and Esther wrote it, and the Anshei Knesset HaGadola finished it. This was written by Mordechai and Esther and the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. Listen to why the verse was written like this. When the maidens were gathered in a second time to see whether any of them would please the queen as much as Esther in her bearing, in her gravitas, Mordechai was already sitting at the king's gate, not because Esther's intervention, but because God affected it supernaturally. His rise to power is considered supernatural because he was a Jew and it was impossible in Persian media for a Jew to rise to such a position. Now, I remember Benjamin Disraeli was a prime minister of England, but in order to take the position, he had to renounce his Judaism because a Jew can't be a prime minister. That's what happened. So too, we see Mordechai, who was reviled as a Jew, but he didn't give up his Judaism. If anything, he was the frummest Jew in the world. And he kept his frumkeit, and he was still in a matter. That's like Benjamin Disraeli being like a Hasidic Rebbe. Could you imagine? Like the Gera Rebbe becomes the Prime Minister of the UK. Back in the Victorian era, it would be unheard of. It would have to be supernatural. So too, the same thing. Also, Yosef was rushed out of prison as a convicted criminal, and overnight a Hebrew slave, who you couldn't even eat with the Hebrews, was now made viceroy over the whole country. It's divine intervention. No power base, no knocking on doors, no photographs with babies. He just, boom, he's already, why? Minas Shemayim. Now you might argue that although Esther did not at this stage recommend Mordechai's status, and although she did not reveal anything about her origin when she was taken to the palace, perhaps she did disclose something about her being Jewish immediately after she was taken. And therefore, you could put two and two together and say, you know what? As we all know, this Esther's got a special chain about her. Hagar was already convinced she was going to be queen. Maybe it makes sense to us to promote Mordechai. That's why verse 20 is written to totally knock that idea on the head. For even after Esther was taken, she still did not tell about her origin or her people. That's what it says in verse 20, just to knock that idea on the head. Mordechai's rise to power, therefore, must be nothing but divine providence. It's got nothing to do with Esther's relationship to him, and he wouldn't have got there by himself. So how did he get there? Mordechai got his position exclusive from Esther. It was a completely separate event, and it was a totally separate miracle. God was organizing this again to knock on the head the idolatry of Nebuchadnezzar, the idolatry of the drinking of the wine at the party, and the sin of Shaul allowing Agag to live. That's what's being tied up here. And he's merely using Esther and Mordechai as tools to fix up this whole thing. So he put them there. He put them there as the kelim, the utensils they were to be used as God wills. That's interesting. Let's talk about Mordechai getting there. There's a Yalkut Shmoini. A Yalkut Shmoini on Esther 105.3. And he says, you should know, very important, famous Gemara. Famous Gemara. It's a, I say famous Gemara, I can't remember where it is. No, sorry, it's a famous Medrash Tanchuma. Sorry about that. Very famous Medrash Tanchuma. Says there that one who pursues honor, honor runs away from him. One who runs away from honor, honor pursues him. It's a Medrash Tanchuma on Vayikra Nun. That's the source of that. Mordechai did everything to avoid being promoted. He actively did not want to be promoted. It's an important thing to find amongst Tyro jury, to try not to be promoted to places of status. It's a bad idea. Even though he did that, of course, he's going to get promoted, right? But that's only within a Torah community. Being promoted in a Gentile community to a high Gentile status is always a bad sign. Always bad news. And Mordechai would never have wanted it. Being promoted to the Av Sanhedrin is something which you definitely want to shun, but if no one else has got to do it, you've got to do it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has chosen you. Being promoted to be a Gentile minister or take up a position of Gentile authority is extremely bad news for a Jew. And Mordechai would never have wanted it. And he was put there much against his will. Mordechai had been assigned to a high-ranking position, and that's why he was sitting at the king's gate. And that's, you might think, perhaps Esther was therefore permitted to divulge his identity. Verse 20 says, no, she didn't. Once Mordechai was appointed, there was no reason for her to conceal herself, you might have thought. That's why verse 20 says, and Esther still continued to obey Mordechai's directive, even though he was now a man of renown anyway, just as she had when she was being raised by him. Amazing, no? She obeyed Mordechai's word without any speculation, just as she had done when she was being raised by him. Total imunah in the Rav. Esther did not disclose her origin, and that's important, because God determined that Mordechai and Esther would be installed in very high positions in which they could influence Haman's downfall. When the maidens gathered a second time, that is when Esther's ascension to the throne was complete, we see that Mordechai had already been appointed and was sitting at the king's gate in position. And that was not due to Esther, but it was divine. Very interesting. Very interesting. I want to talk more about this idea about being appointed to something in life. It says at the beginning of verse 20, the word tziva, commanded. It says, just as Mordechai had commanded her. But later on, the verse uses the word ma'amar, literally that which Mordechai had said, rather than saying commanded a second time. This is so choshev, what I'm going to tell you, so choshev. Please, please, please listen, it's really, really important. So in the beginning of the verse, it says, tziva aleha, Mordechai. And then it says, ve'es ma'amar. So what's the difference between a tzivui and a mimer? The primary element of Mordechai's command to Esther was that she not tell of her people. Don't say you're Jewish. Because if no one must know that she's Jewish, because then the Persians would not make an exception of her because she was the queen. If she found out she was a Jew, there'd be problems for her and for us in the decree. In this way, Esther could indeed save Israel by declaring to Ahasuerus that it's a disgrace for his own wife to be threatened. And that's what happened in chapter 7, verse 4. go see that there. That's exactly what she said. Disgrace for you to go and have me and my people killed. The key thing is the Judaism bit. Esther did not tell of her people or of her origin. First and foremost, the command at Sivui was not to tell of her people. Then, only secondary to this, Amar, that he said, don't say, was not to divulge her origin of Shevet Halevi. Sorry, Shevet Benjamin. Don't say you're a Benjaminite and don't talk about your connection to me. That's of secondary importance. Mordechai commanded her, as a mitzvah, as it were, midrabbanan, don't say you're Jewish. But he also gave her a direction. He gave her a direction, ma'amar, that she should not divulge her origin. He told her not to reveal that she was Mordechai's uncle's daughter. Why? Because Mordechai shunned positions of authority. And if the Persians found out that Mordechai was the queen's relative, they would surely want to promote him to some high-ranking position. So the reason why it says tziva about being Jewish is to save the Jewish people. The reason why it says ma'amar about saying you're my first cousin is for me personally. I don't want it to affect me. I don't want them to give me high rank. I don't want to get affected by this. Forget the Jewish people. Me, I don't want to get pushed to a high rank. So there's a personal thing and there's a national thing. The national thing is a command. You have to save the Jews. Personally, I'm instructing you not to say anything to do with me. I don't want anything to do with the Persian government. Stay far from the government. So P.K. Avos says, stay far from politics. Now you might turn around and say, ooh, well, now that Mordechai had been divinely promoted to the position at the gate anyway, what difference does it make? Now that he's got the position that he would have got, had Esther have said, oh, by the way, I'm his first cousin, she might as well just tell everyone. She didn't, because she listened to the Rav. To her, it would make no difference now. Mordechai's been promoted to what he would have got had she have said, by the way, he's my first cousin anyway. So she might as well say, oh, by the way, that's my first cousin. What difference does it make? She still kept quiet because it's a mitzvah midrabbanan. I'm doing what the Torah told me. I'm listening to the Rav. Even though it would make no difference. He only told her, don't tell about me, so he wouldn't get promoted. He's been promoted. So what difference does it make? That's why the verse says, as Mordechai commanded, and as he had said, as he had spoken to her. She was very loyal to his directives. There is a Gemara in Yuma, Daf Talad Omad Beis, 4b. And it says, anyone who is told something by his friend must not divulge it until his friend explicitly permits him to do so. Which means what? Everything's confidential unless you have been given a clause to be allowed to say it over. You got to think a lot about this. Someone tells you something, it is secret unless they say you can tell people. You have to treat it like that. This applies even if his friend had not expressly requested that he refrain from divulging the information. You have to treat all information as confidential unless you are explicitly told or you request and are granted permission to give over that data to others. Essentially, there's always professional confidentiality unless explicitly stated. This is why in each section of the Torah, the verse says, God spoke to Moses saying, rather than just, and God spoke to Moses. Have you ever wondered, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe l'amor, how many times do we need to be told, and God spoke to Moses saying, and God spoke, just say, Moses told the people, God told me this. Why must God himself go on record and quote unquote waste ink that we don't need, saying, God, no, it's necessary. God spoke to Moses. Now, that would be confidential. Unless Moses has been told explicitly to tell this over, it is forbidden for him to relay what God has told him because one person has told someone else something. Can't say it. That's why God goes on record in the Torah to say, I am telling Moshe to say this over. That's why you know about it. Isn't that amazing? Chas v'shalom that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would be non-confidential. He keeps to confidentiality. He can keep a secret. And if he's telling you something, he'll be explicit to say, by the way, I told my prophet to tell you this. Because he keeps his own Torah. It was clearly that Hashem's wish that Esther and her origin not be known at this stage. As we're going to learn in 2:21, coming up hopefully in a second, that in the days of Bigson and Seresh, they were angry. If it were already known at the king's gate that Mordechai was related to the queen, people would have said that the whole episode was a conspiracy between Esther and Mordechai, and that they got Bigson and Seresh in to get killed and have Mordechai appointed in their place. That's what people would have said. Because they were also in the gate, Bigson and Seresh. There's also an opinion in Medrash Esther Rabbah, Vav Yud Gimel. It's a good one, that's 613, I like that one. Which says that the king appointed Mordechai in the palace, specifically in the place where Bigson and Seresh were. And if we knew that Mordechai was related to Esther, people would say that the plot to kill Bigson and Seresh was a conspiracy planned to prevent Bigson and Seresh from appealing that Mordechai be ousted and they reinstated. Essentially, it would be like a political assassination. That's why nobody knew, so nobody would come to that false idea. Let's look at verse 21. In those days, and while Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate, that's already been introduced, two royal chamberlains from the gatekeepers, Bigson and Seresh, were angered and plotted to assassinate King Ahasuerus. Okay? Wouldn't it have been okay just to say, in those days, Bigson and Seresh became angry? Why add that Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate? So the Medrash Esther Rabbah says that King Ahasuerus appointed Mordechai instead of Bigson and Seresh, and that's why they were angered. It's also that the purpose of the verse is to teach that the children of Israel the tremendous power for Shkocha Protis, because in Medrash Esther Rabbah 7:13, it says that Haman planned to trap Israel into participating into the feast so they'd be sent into annihilation. We discussed that earlier with the whole thing to do with the wine being Avodah Zorah to trigger Nebuchadnezzar's Avodah Zorah back in the days of Daniel, right? But in the end, Haman himself was destroyed through a feast. So Haman would be capable of planning his own downfall through the feast. It was necessary that Haman holds a prominent position, and so does Mordechai. God's organizing the situation to get this to happen. So the Medrash Esther Rabbah, Zion Base 7:2, says that in order to amplify the magnitude of Haman's downfall, he was first appointed to a high-ranking position. Amazing. I think there's a Gentile statement, the higher they are, the greater they fall. I think so. I think that's the taller they are. Sometimes Hashem will promote someone to a high famous position just to knock them off it and make it all the more spectacular as a punishment. Think about it. If Haman was a clerk who was assigned to the Department of Toilet Paper, and then he was knocked off of his position, who cares? It's a nobody. But Haman being assigned to such a high viceroy position and he losing it, it's covered Shemayim. It gives God honor, because the Hashkocha Pratis is all the more magnified when you see someone of very high rank losing their position in order to save the Jews. So God, for the covet of himself, as it were, for Shemayim, and for the covet of the Jews, wanted to promote Haman to the highest level. So when he knocked him off, it looked all the more spectacular. So it was divine intervention to promote, and we'll learn that it was very divine to promote Haman, because it was counterintuitive to promote Haman at that time. And it was counterintuitive to promote Mordechai at all. Both had to be in place for the spectacular finale of knocking Haman off of his perch, so that it looked clearly like a Shkocha Protis, even to the most basic observer. That was God's doing. That was God's doing. Now, after God had arranged that Esther be crowned queen and Mordechai be promoted to a position at the king's gate, you've got to get Haman in place. You've got to get all the pieces on the chessboard in place for the ultimate checkmate, right? This is going to be a spectacular win. So God had the king's servants rebel in anger so that Mordechai would report their treachery to Ahasuerus and that his good deed would be recorded in the royal chronicles in the logs. And that's why Harbona later in Esther 7:9, when Haman fell upon Esther, says, the tree which Haman had prepared for Mordechai, who had spoken good for the king, is standing in Haman's house. He said, hang him on it. We wouldn't have had that happen unless we know about Bigson and Seresh and Mordechai saving him and getting everyone in place. The Medrash Yalkut Esther says that Bigson and Seresh's conspiracy, do you know who planned it? Bigson was furious. It was Bigson, by the way, not Seresh, that did this. We'll learn about that. Bigson was furious about Mordechai taking his job, so he wanted to get Mordechai out of the way. Who did he go to figure out a plot to get rid of Mordechai? Haman. He knew Haman was good at this because he saw how he got Vashti out of a plot that we learnt about in the first parak. It was him who politically moved Vashti out the way, like a chess move, because he wanted to get higher up in the king's esteem. Vashti was an omelette that needed an egg cracking, you know what I mean? Let's move her out of position, let's kill her. Bigson saw that, so he went to Haman and said, I've got the same problem, but with a Jew. Can you help me out? Haman said, yeah, no problem, we'll get rid of him. It was Haman's counsel that Bigson said, you know what, poison the food. Kill the king, get yourself in position, and then frame it on Mordechai. It was Haman's own counsel that got Bigson and Seresh in problem, which promoted Mordechai. Then he ended up having to walk Mordechai down the street while Mordechai's on the horse with a crown on his head. It was Haman's idea. Unbelievable. So after these events, which is Mordechai and Esther being ascended, and the tree of Haman. Haman had a tree being put in his garden, all being organized. The king promoted Haman. But Haman was already doomed. That's what it means in those days while Mordechai was sitting at the gate. In other words, in those days when Esther was in power as queen and Mordechai also had power at the king's gate. That's why it says, and while Mordechai was sitting, the rise of Haman's opponents was already in equal proportion to Esther and Mordechai's promotion as well. You've got to understand, there's a whole political change happening here. Now, I've got to get back to this thing about being promoted in a Gentile way. The Rabbonim have taught that honour pursues one who runs away from it. Medrash Tanchuma, Parshas Vayikra, Ois Nun. However, a non-Jewish position of honour, such as Mordechai's appointment, is undesirable. It's a Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Ethics of the Fathers, Chapter 1, Mishnah 10, says you should not be overly familiar with the government. Stay far from politics. But Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate. He was in a Gentile position of power. Why did God find Mordechai a place at the king's gate, even though he had actively tried to avoid positions of honour? And why was Haman's fate determined through Mordechai's actions? It says, in those days, while Mordechai was sitting at the gate, it transpired that Bigson and Seresh were angered, and subsequently the matter became known to Mordechai, and that led to Haman's downfall. Mordechai used his position to try to implore his brethren not go to the party and try to protect them. When he got to a position of power, he was using his leverage to protect his own brethren. What did God do? I'll let you protect your own brethren by relating over the Bigson and Seresh and saving every single Jew in the world. Now notice in the clause where it says, and Bigson and Seresh were angered. It says, and Bigson and Seresh were angered. What does it say? It says, Kotsaf. They were angered. Kotsaf. That's in the singular. Not katsafoi, in the plural, they were angry, which would be far more grammatically. It says, and angered, personally, one individual, and they were angered, one individual. Now, the Rabbonim say in the Gemara Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, one of them said to the other, from the time Esther has arrived, we haven't slept. Let us take poison and slip it into his goblet, Ahasuerus, so that he'll die. Enough of this. But the other responded, my watch isn't the same as yours. So Rashi said, what does he mean? You're appointed for one task, I'm appointed for another. How can we collaborate in carrying out our plan? Because we're on different watches. We're on different duties. So the Gemara says, so the other one answered, I'll undertake my watch and yours, you help me. This teaches that only one of them was the instigator and the other one joined in. That's why it says katsuf in the singular. Big son alone was the angry one and he dragged Seresh along with him. That's why it means two royal chamberlains from the gatekeepers. These men had only one thing in common. They were both from the gatekeepers. But there were various categories. There were different kind of gatekeepers. And these two servants had diverse functions. So Big Son and Seresh had diverse tasks. And only Seresh was a gatekeeper. So that's why it means, really you should read it, Big Son, comma, and Seresh from the gatekeepers. The matter became known to Mordechai, and he told it to Esther the queen, and Esther repeated it to the king in Mordechai's name. Very, very important. If you don't mind, if you hold on an extra 4 or 5 minutes, we can finish the next two psukim and the entire perek. The whole of perek base will complete now. We're just two more psukim. So if you don't mind, just give me a couple of minutes and we'll do the whole perek. This is an unbelievable lesson. It's a lesson in Midas. This is a lesson in Midas. A man should not seek peace and goodness exclusively for himself and saying God will look after everybody else. In fact, the opposite should be done. If you're concerned only for your own welfare and your fellow conducts himself in the same way, then God does good for neither. That's why there's a famous Gemara in Gemara Bava Kama, Daf Tzadi Beis Omad Aleph 92a, and says, on the Pasuk in Eiv, Job 42:10, God restored Job's fortune when he prayed for his friend. Says the Gemara, anyone who prays for his fellow while he is in need of the same thing will be answered first. That means if you're in a position of power, use that to help the populace. Don't just amass wealth and power for yourself. Both Mordechai and Esther had chesed for the Yidden. And each of them in their own way made sure to do chesed for Klal Yisrael. That's what it means. The matter became known to Mordechai. Anyone else would have made a point of informing the king personally and taking credit. Mordechai wished only that Esther would benefit. He said, oh, look, I've got an opportunity to put Esther in a good position. I'll give her this secret data about the thing. Hopefully the king will like her more. He didn't do it himself to raise himself. He did it for Esther. What did Esther do? I'm not going to do it for myself. Maybe I could give Mordechai a good. Instead of taking this and I'll promote myself as queen, I'll tell over to Achashverosh what happened. And I said, there's this guy called Mordechai that did it. So Mordechai told Esther to do it. And Esther said it was Mordechai. They loved each other. They loved Klal Yisrael. Everybody remember labad schus on someone else. If you get an opportunity to do something for someone else, do it. Don't do it for yourself. And let that person do you a good turn. Unbelievable. Selfless benevolence of both of them. That's a sign of greatness of each of them. Verse 23, end of Perek Beis. The matter was investigated. Yuvukash. They looked into it. They didn't just trust Mordechai or Esther. They went and got detectives. And it was confirmed. And they were both hanged on a tree. Big Son and Seresh. And it was recorded in the Book of Chronicles before the king. It was logged as a crime number 1683246-4. It was put in the books. Listen very carefully what's happened. There's a massive medrash on this. There's a medrash Esther Rabba, Aleph, Tes Vov. And it says, Achashverosh, bizarrely, is praised by the medrash. Very unusual. He was not a good guy. He was like a Hitler in his day. And Haman was like a Himmler, Yimach Shemoy, right? But there's a good piece of information here. It was only later, when Achashverosh could not sleep, that he asked for his book of Chronicles to be brought. And there he discovered that Mordechai had informed him, because Esther actually wrote it down in the book in Mordechai's name, not her own, of the plot to assassinate him. And he was very puzzled by this. And he said, what's been done for Mordechai? Surely there's some kind of payment. Now the Targum says, in Mordechai's name, does not refer to Esther telling the king of the episode, but it is recorded in the king's book in Mordechai's name. The queen told the king, and it was recorded in Mordechai's name. So it was only written about Mordechai, not Esther. Very interesting. Why didn't Esther mention herself in the book as well? She was scared. She says, if I tell Mordechai to inform the king himself, and if it isn't confirmed, let's say they go and look and they can't prove it, they'll think Mordechai was a slanderer and they get him killed. That's a very valid point, says the Yalkut Shmoni. Indeed, when the detectives went there, they looked for the goblet with the poison in and it had been thrown out. Now think about how bad that would have been. Could you imagine that goblet which had been thrown out? And they go look and they say, no, Big Son and Seresh are loyal. Mordechai and Esther are planning to assassinate the king to promote themselves. They'd have both got killed. What happened? Says the Medrash on Yalkut Shmoni. Listen to what had to happen. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent the Archangel Gavriel to put a snake in the cup of water that when the detectives got there, they found the snake in the jug, which would show that someone had certainly tried to poison the king, and otherwise the matter would remain hidden and even backfired on Mordechai and Esther. You see how important this is? God had to get involved to save the day. Because when the detectives went and found it, they wouldn't find anything out of the ordinary. They'd say this prayer came from Mordechai the Jew. He was, look at these Jews trying to ingratiate themselves. Let's kill him instead. The whole thing of Purim would have been over at that point. If Gavriel would have not put a snake in that jug at God's behest, the whole thing would have gone. God had to intercede, says Yalkut Shmoni. And Esther said, if I don't inform him at all, and if the matter is discovered, as Mordechai said, she, Esther, will be accused of withholding information and get into trouble. That's why Esther decided that Mordechai himself should not inform the king, but she should tell the king in Mordechai's name. She felt as if the matter would be confirmed, then when the scribes came to record it, they would come to her. And she would tell the scribes exactly how it became known, and that would explain that Mordechai had informed her. And in that way, the king would find out and feel indebted to Mordechai, not her. But if the matter could not be confirmed, Esther would say that Mordechai only heard about it, and therefore he wasn't to blame. So the king realized two things. What was puzzling him, said the Targum? Firstly, Mordechai didn't come directly to him to inform him of the conspiracy. That's very odd. Why would he go to Esther? That's puzzling, isn't it? What's his connection to Esther? Who's he? The king thought, Mordechai didn't act in my best interests. He went to the queen and not directly to me, and that shows that he's not really concerned about my welfare. Were it not for Esther's sympathy, I would have died. This Mordechai's a no good, Nick. Two, Ahasuerus didn't receive this information as a fact, but rather as a report that someone else had overheard. It's because of this that the verse uses the word for Tamar, and Esther said she related, rather than saying for Sargid that she related directly, conclusively. It wasn't definite. When the king's scribes recorded the event, they conducted a thorough inquiry to establish the facts, and they found the snake in the jug that the Malach Gavriel put there, and they said, yeah, tuck it, it was Big Son and Seresh. It's really true. So Esther provided those specific facts. Now, during the inquiry, Esther set everything correct. First, she didn't mention her name at all in the report. She stated only that Mordechai had disclosed the details. Secondly, to demonstrate that Mordechai's failure to inform the king was not against the king's best interest, she reversed the order of things. She didn't write Big Son and Seresh conspired to assassinate the king and Mordechai revealed it. Rather, she said Mordechai told the conspiracy by Big Son and Seresh to assassinate the king. Had she kept it in the original order, that would have been emphasized. And Mordechai's revelation is mentioned first to highlight that Mordechai's motivation was only to save the king's life. That's why the report says in 7:4, Mordechai told this whole thing, and in this way it was made clear that Mordechai only wanted to prevent the plot for the king, not because of some secret plot with Esther. So when it was read to him when he couldn't sleep, he asked what favour had been done for Mordechai now that you've sent detectives and you know for sure that it was as Mordechai had heard and he did have my best interests. Now, at that time, the king was so convinced that Mordechai had done him no service that he didn't even care to supervise how the matter was being written. When it actually happened, he felt as if Mordechai was just speaking to Esther. So that's why now when he's reading it after the fact that actually it was true that Mordechai did him a good turn, he said, yeah, Taka, I never did anything for him because I always suspected him of doing something for himself. But now that you've looked into it, it turns out he really was helping me. What have we done for him? They said, well, because at the time you weren't so sure, nothing. Because you had a doubt as to whether or not he told you for your benefit or for Esther's benefit, we didn't do anything for him until we did an investigation. He goes, no, what happened? Well, the investigation found actually it was true and he did you a good turn. And he goes, well, what good turn was done for him? Nothing. We never got round to it. Oh, the stage is set for now Mordechai to be promoted. And he says, well, what do you mean nothing's been done for him? Well, nothing's been done for him. Who was in the courtyard? Haman came in. What would you do for something that, you know, if you really wanted to do someone a good favor, what would you do? And that whole thing transpired at that point. That would only happen if Mordechai was sitting at the gate and Big Son and Seresh were sitting at the gate and Mordechai was put there anyway to start with and Mordechai related to Esther, who was also acceded as the queen. If she wasn't in a good position to tell the king, that would have never been related and Mordechai and Esther would have never brought down Haman. The whole thing had to be divinely orchestrated just so in the right time and in the right place to politically get Mordechai and Esther the right power they needed to overthrow Haman. And without all these unbelievable coincidences aligning all at the same time, despite that Esther was kicking and screaming not even to be queen, and Mordechai didn't want a position of honour, same thing, notice they both didn't want the honour, and yet they got there anyway. If all of those things wouldn't have happened, Klal Yisrael would not have been saved. There's so much Hashgacha Pratis, it's impossible to read Esther without seeing it like that. And with that, we conclude Perek Beis. Now, we're going to take a break for Pesach, and then next time start Perek Gimel, the third Perek, which is where we have this whole thing about Haman being raised to a tremendous... Now we need to learn about Haman being politically raised. And then we've got to do the Medrash Rabbah, which talks about what we've already discussed, that God was fattening Haman up for the slaughter. Before you have calves or pigs that are taken to slaughter, first you fatten them up to make them nice and tasty before you kill them. God, as it were, was fattening up Haman for slaughter. And now we've got to fatten him up by bringing him up to political position where it's going to make a good thing to knock him off of his perch. So I've got to bring him up to position. And that's what we're going to learn about in the Medrash Rabbah at the beginning of Perek Gimel.